Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Welcome, everyone, to the Council of Trent for our first part two episode in this podcast. We're bringing back Randall Rouser. Last time, Randall and I were talking about bad arguments for atheism, for the denial or rejection of a belief in God. This time, it's bad arguments against atheism that believers make and probably shouldn't make. For those of you who weren't listening last time, let me introduce you to Randall. Randall Rouser is a systematic and analytic theologian of evangelical persuasion. He's driven by apologetic concerns and, above all, the tireless pursuit of truth. He is the professor of historical theology at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton. And he's the author of several books, including Is the Atheist My Neighbor? And What's So Confusing About Grace? Randall, welcome back to the Council of Trent.
Great to be back.
All right, so this time we're changing gears a little bit. We're talking about arguments against atheism, which is kind of an odd way to put it. Do you think there's a difference between arguments for theism, for belief in God, and arguments against atheism, or are they just kind of basically the same?
Well, they are different. An argument for theism would give you a reason to believe God exists. An argument against atheism might just simply give you a reason to withhold belief as to whether atheism is true or not. There is one important difference. If you're doing argument for theism, that's often understood to be offensive apologetics, which is making a positive case. If you're arguing against atheism, that's often understood to be defensive apologetics, where you're critiquing alternative views.
So, like, answering the problem of evil would be kind of defensive apologetics. The Kalam cosmological argument, going on the offense, but not being an obnoxious individual in the sense of being offensive.
We always want to keep those two distinct. Offensive is not offensive. That's right. Hopefully not.
Hopefully. All righty. Well, you hear Christians make different arguments, against atheism, whether it's evidence for God or trying to show that atheism is not something you should believe in. What would you say is the absolute worst argument you hear Christians make often against atheism?
Okay, I'm not sure if this is the worst, because there are some crazy ones, but this one is widespread, and so I thought it's really worth talking about. And that is the practice of conflating or confusing atheism with reductive naturalism. So naturalism is the view that only nature exists. And reductive naturalism tries to say that all the things that, like minds and moral values, consciousness, things like that, that they are all reducible to matter in motion, to particles. And I will often encounter Christians who say they're critiquing atheism, which is, as we defined in the last podcast, the denial that God exists. But what they actually do is they're critiquing reductive naturalism. And you could be an atheist and utterly reject reductive naturalism. So that's a big mistake.
So this is kind of the inverse of another bad argument for atheism, that some atheists will say that Christians who believe that the world was created 6,000 years ago in 6 days, they're wrong about evolution. Therefore, God doesn't exist. They're attacking too narrow of a target.
That's exactly right. Yes, we often see that in reverse. And it's interesting. I mean, you'll often see atheists criticizing the version of Christianity that they rejected when they became an atheist. So this is the other side of it, that Christians will often attack some version of atheism rather than atheism as a broader target. And in its worst case, that could be the example of committing the straw man fallacy.
So for our listeners who aren't aware, the straw man fallacy is when you take an opponent's argument and you unintentionally or intentionally, you make it weaker, and then you attack that misrepresentation of his view. So rather than straw manning an opponent, I've heard this term recently, we should actually steel man them, make their argument stronger, and then refute it anyways. Would you agree?
Oh, exactly. Straw manning doesn't really serve anybody. It may win the short-term battle, but it will not win the long-term war, because when people realize that you're sort of caricaturing their beliefs or misrepresenting their beliefs, you're going to lose your audience and you'll be discredited. It's far better in the long term to try to engage with your opponents in the most rigorous form of their argument, because then people will view you as a trustworthy source in matters of debate and discussion.
All right. If this isn't the worst argument. It's probably pretty high up on the list. There's an argument I hear Christians make against atheism, which basically claims atheists don't really exist. Like, people who say they're atheists still secretly believe in God. They just don't want to admit it, or they're rebelling against God. In fact, you wrote a whole book on that argument. Why don't, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the book is called Is the Atheist My Neighbor? And I refer to this thesis as the rebellion thesis. The idea being that all belief or all atheism is in fact in bad faith, that these are people who are actively and morally suppressing their knowledge of God because they don't want to believe in God. I'll give you an example. R.C. Sproul, a recently deceased, well-known conservative Christian apologist, was once at a university, and he gave arguments for God's existence to an atheist club. And then afterwards, he says, but you know what? I'm bringing coals to Newcastle because you don't actually disbelieve God exists. You really know he exists, and you hate him. Now, can you imagine what it was like to be in that audience?
Well, unless he truly were as clairvoyant as he tried to make himself out to be, being told what you believe, if that's not accurate, that's going to get on people's nerves.
Yes. And so, I mean, that's a good point in and of itself, that even if you end up believing the rebellion thesis about atheism, it's probably wise not to tell an atheist that, because it'll just burn your bridge. Now, it is a good question as to why people believe this. And I think a couple reasons are from biblical texts. They will go to Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And they will go to Romans 1:20 that says God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen so that people are without excuse. And they will take those verses and to say that that supports the conclusion that people are sinfully suppressing their knowledge of God.
What's wrong with using those verses to support the idea that everybody believes in God, whether they admit it or not?
Yeah, I think that what's going on here is what we often call proof texting, which is taking a text out of context and using it as a pretext to defend some particular view. So in Psalm 14, I think what we have to do is simply read the entire psalm. It goes on and it talks about all people as being sinful and fallen. There's no one who is without excuse. So Psalm 14 is not talking about atheists. In fact, the very idea of an atheist in the ancient Hebrew world would be very anachronistic. It's a later idea. Rather, it's talking about all people being sinful. And in particular, it's talking about the fact that people have knowledge of God but don't act upon that knowledge. And that, in fact, describes the entire human race, not just atheists. Now, in terms of Romans 1:20, I would just want to say one thing. If that was a correct interpretation of what's going on in Romans 1:20, it would not only be the atheist who is sinful and suppressing their knowledge of God, it would also be every Christian, every theist who has ever had any doubt as to God's existence or his nature. Consider, for example, Mother Teresa. After her death in 1997, we know that her journals were published, and we see in there a real human being wrestling with faith and even doubting God's very existence at times. And if this interpretation of Romans 1:20 were correct, Mother Teresa would be sinful. She would be suppressing her knowledge of God. And it seems to me that's not a charitable or appropriate interpretation of her doubt at all.
Right. I think that if you're a listener and you think atheists are just suppressing belief in God, that they just obviously know God exists, that doesn't really make sense of when believers themselves have doubts about the existence of God, when something very terrible happens. I mean, they're not making these doubts so that they can go sin without abandon. They're having a kind of crisis of faith. In fact, for Catholics, if we look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the Catechism says that man is capable of knowing that God exists by reason alone, but there can be times where he's born into, you know, certain circumstances where he's prevented from having a true intimacy with God, or there are things, you know, maybe he's born in a very atheistic environment like the Soviet Union that prejudices him against believing in God. So, yeah, I don't think it's definitely a good strategy to try to attack atheism by saying that atheists don't really exist. And I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Randall, but when I've come across this argument, I usually find it most heavily in Reformed or Calvinist circles. Do you think that's just a coincidence, or there might be something deeper there?
I think that is true, and it's probably a reflection of Calvinist views of sin and sort of strong emphasis upon human sin and impacting every aspect of the human person and the human will. When I wrote that book, though, I certainly found examples throughout church history of Christians, Catholic and Protestant and across the spectrum, often demonizing people who are atheists. And it just really undermines our witness to the world.
Right. Yeah. And so for me, that's anyone, any Christian who's doing that, whatever theological persuasion they belong to, it's just so unfortunate. That's why, as I said, like in the catechism, if we look at paragraph 2125, I think this is a great thing that we find in there. It talks about how atheism is a sin because you're failing to give God the worship he's due. But in 2125, that paragraph of the catechism, it says, the imputability of this offense can be significantly diminished in virtue of the intentions and the circumstances. It goes on to say, believers can have more than a little to do with the rise of atheism to the extent that they are careless about their instruction in the faith or present its teaching falsely or even fail in their religious, moral, or social life. They may be said to conceal rather than reveal the true nature of God. So definitely something for all of us to keep into account and know that there are people out there who really struggle with the existence of God, and we want to walk them towards the existence of God in a careful, critical, gracious, and persuasive way. So, Randall, how can we help Christians use their critical thinking? You know, maybe they want to decimate atheistic arguments. How do we help them turn it back and see that maybe some of their own arguments aren't as strong as they think they are?
I think I'd want to begin with the recognition that we are people of Israel. We've been grafted into Israel according to Romans 9-11. And what Israel means, the term comes from Genesis 32, when Jacob wrestles with the angel through the night. In the morning, he is given the name Israel because he has strived with God. To be Israel is to struggle or strive with God. And when we look at our own beliefs, ask hard questions of our own beliefs, wrestle through doubts, seek to better understand that which we believe, we are being Israel. We are struggling with God. Now, I came from a tradition that looked askance, that looked suspiciously at this kind of wrestling with faith. It seemed to be impious and not to show the kind of certainty and trust that was expected of a good disciple. But I now realize that to struggle with God, in fact, shows piety, it shows intimacy with God, that we are not afraid to ask the hard questions and seek truth wherever it may be found.
It reminds me of the verse in 1 Peter 5, that if there are people who are struggling with the existence of God or it causes you anxiety, you should actually bring that to God. In 1 Peter 5, it says, we should cast all our anxieties on him, for he cares for us. And he especially cares for us when we are having that dark night of the soul where we're wondering if God is there, whether we're a believer who's still struggling or an unbeliever wondering if they should make that leap of faith, you know, take Pascal up on his wager, basically. Well, Randall, it was really a joy to have you on these two episodes, and I'm sure we'll have you back again in the future. For our listeners who weren't here at part one, can you let them know where they can learn more about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, you can find me online at my website, randallrauser.com, RANDALRAUSER.com. I've written 11 books, which you can find at Amazon and fine and not so fine bookstores everywhere. Thanks a lot for having me, Trent. It's been a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun as well. Take care.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.